Hi, welcome to another Applied Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Reeve. Today I'm sitting down with Tommy Happynick Jr., almost Tammy there, who is with Indigenous Education and Community Connections. He teaches Indigenous Studies program. He also teaches in the Indigenous College Prep program and the Indigenous Family Support. Thank you, Tommy, for showing up and being here with us today. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about your experience here at Commotion, just a little bit about you. I've given you a very brief intro, maybe just a bit more about you and your experience here at Commotion.
My experience at Commotion has began as a student several decades ago. And then after I finished my MA at UVic, I got hired as a community liaison. So I was working primarily out in community, which was really good in terms of building those relationships for what came later.
Right.
I've also worked as an Indigenous advisor. And just up until the summer, I was the elders coordinator as well at the college. And now I'm completely teaching within those programs. And so I like to think that my whole time at Commotion has really helped me with my teaching, because I've been out in community, I've worked with community, I've worked with students in community and at the college, and so I feel like that's all the work that came before the teaching allowed me to have a better understanding of the student experience, that particularly the Indigenous student experience.
Right.
And I think it's been beneficial for me anyway in terms of how I teach and what I teach.
Okay. And that's going to lead in very nicely, because of course we're going to be talking today about applied learning. What are your values around teaching learning when it inspired you? Like, where was the connection between when you transitioned to that teacher role to incorporate applied learning ideas?
Mm. I stumbled into teaching. And it's kind of funny because they needed someone to fill in to teach the Indigenous Ways of Knowing course within the Indigenous Studies program. And we were having lots of discussions, and then my name came up, and then I ended up teaching three courses that term, which seems to be the way things go, you know, right into the fire, or right. out of the frying pan into the fire. But my sort of teaching philosophies and the values I bring come from my Indigenous education more than the Western education that I have.
Right.
And so when I don't think of myself as an instructor or a professor or any of those sort of titles that go along with post-secondary education, I really think of myself as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the reason that I think that way is because within an Indigenous worldview, there's a relationship between a teacher and students, but it's a two-way relationship. And so for me, I end up learning as much, I think, as the students learn in the whole process. And so the way that my classes are structured are slightly more seminar than lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And so I expect a lot of discussion and participation in the courses, and that comes from the cultural education that I received growing up, and this idea that students need to be actively involved in the learning process to get the most out of the learning that we're doing. And so I guide discussions, I choose topics, but I encourage students to bring in the knowledge that they already carry and the experience that they already carry into the classroom, so that we can be having discussions on topics that are actually related to their own experiences, and that they, and then the learning that they do in the classroom, that they can then take that out and apply it to their own understanding of the world.
Right.
So, you know, if we're talking about Indigenous ways of knowing, I will provide, I'll try to encourage the opportunity for actual applied learning in that as well. And so, you know, we'll do a number of classes that lead up to a CEDAR workshop. And then it's that CEDAR workshop where the elders that I work with come in and they tie everything that the students have been learning into the CEDAR work that, that the students are participating in. And so they do some learning, so this sort of this theory bit,
right?
And then we take it to an indigenous art form in cedar weaving, mm-hmm. and we apply it. And so you really, I've noticed over the years, and so do the elders who I work with. They notice how through the discussions that the students are having that they're really almost weaving together the all of the theories and the methodologies and the things, the content of the course, into what they end up producing.
Right.
And so I think that applied, for me, applied learning has to be a part of everything that I do, because I don't adhere to the idea that students need to learn what I think they need to learn. I think students need to be involved in that learning process. And so when we create opportunities for them to you know, the students who have done weaving before, mm-hmm. they become teachers in this classroom. And so they gather small groups of students and they work together. And then we see all of these things coming together. And so it's amazing. The applied pieces of the courses that I teach are the most beneficial, I think, to the students.
We've heard that time and again, mm-hmm. With all the instructors. And I want to move us now and... for the listeners who have listened to multiple podcasts, we know we're going to work through the eight principles here. And already, Tommy, you've talked about, really, you've sort of got to the heart of it already with talking. It sounds like you're really talking about the intention of where you're coming from and mm-hmm. where your students are and where you're hoping that they will lead themselves and you will be part of that. So intention just means that idea at the beginning, that eureka of what is it at the essence of what you're really hoping to get out of this environment, this educational mm-hmm. environment. And it sounds like you've already kind of addressed that. Is when you go about choosing what activities, what is the idea you have in mind in terms of what you hope students will get out of it? Like mm-hmm. you mentioned weaving as one. Why weaving, for example? What is your intention really behind weaving?
One, my family has a background in weaving. My great grandmother is a world renowned weaver, and so it's something familiar to me that I feel confident enough that I can talk about and I can answer questions with, and I can, because I've been around weaving my whole life, I'm able to incorporate the concepts that we talk about or the questions that students have into a project that's around weaving.
Right.
But I think it could work with any sort of applied learning project, right. whether it's you're out in the walking around campus and talking about biology, or you're, you know, what the environmental tech students are doing, you know, about actively participating, being a part of the natural world while you're learning. And so, you know, I think whatever applied tool you choose to use, what for me, the intention piece is to take students out of a space in which they either expect to be mm-hmm. or are used to, and try to have them do learning from a slightly different perspective.
Right.
So trying to understand that, yes, we're here in a classroom and we're weaving and we're sitting with elders and we're sharing stories and experiences. And yet that is no less valuable or important than listening to me lecture for 2 hours or 3 hours or whatever. Right. And so I found that when students are actively engaged in multiple ways, and so not necessarily just listening and participating, you know, verbally, but engaging their physical, their mental, their emotional, and their spiritual being as a whole within a specific type of project. The intention is to get them out of their head. and learning by touching and feeling and interacting with others in a way that they normally wouldn't. Like.
And I think what you just said there is the way you just described it, Tommy, to me is resonates with so many of the other instructors that they may not use exactly the same language, but to break with their formalized expectations of what learning looks like, feels like, seems like, who it's with, how is that relationship? Mm-hmm. I think that's a common thread through many of the different applied learning is to sort of have students, challenge students to rethink what learning really is. Yeah. And in some ways, the intention point is to I'm not describing it in a way I think as apt as you, but I describe it sometimes as to unlearn high school.
Yes.
You know, yeah. That there are certain standards that, and in high school, of course, is changing. We know the curriculum is changing. That we want our students to be able to see learning as a much broader experience than merely here's a test, here's a mark, mm-hmm. here defines how your relationship to learning based on that number.
Yeah. You can engage with a book and the natural world. And, deeply, and the learning you get from both, different, but
right,
but equally valuable.
Okay, so let's move on now to curriculum preparedness and planning. So, in the way applied learning is described, it's sometimes seen as two circles, and the inner circle is the work of preparation, and the second wheel is part of the student experience and the student learning. But of course, these I think of it more as a spiral of one on top of the other, layering. We're going to focus a little bit on your preparation. You know, you said you were kind of the first time you were kind of thrown into teaching, but you had a background. You've been educated and been an educator through your life, pretty much the whole way through. Maybe you can talk about how you, when you prepare, how do you begin your preparations for something that's going to challenge students about the way they think? There's something, we'll call it applied learning. How do you begin your preparations for like, okay, the class will, you know, four classes in, we'll hope to get to here, or maybe by the end of the semester, we'll hope to, you know, the whatever the project is, we hope to get there. What's your sort of process? How do you prepare yourself and your setup for that?
That's a good question. It will always depend on the group that I'm with. And so I don't often bring in the explicitly applied learning piece,
right?
Sort of the project or the workshop or whatever, until I've had a month or so to get to know the students and maybe had a couple of really good critical discussions with them, and so I can kind of get a sense of where they're at. Because I'm always mindful that I don't want to be passing on knowledge that students aren't ready for. And so in my preparation, it's really about getting to know the students, where they're at, and trying to ensure that I've shared the important information and philosophies so that students can feel comfortable with how we're going to be learning. And so I'm often right away I'm preparing students for these right. concepts. You know, I say this isn't going to be a class like you're maybe used to.
Right.
You know, I don't teach in a way that you may be used to. You know, sitting in a circle right away.
Right.
That's a big piece, right? Because that changes the classroom almost immediately.
Right.
And you know, you see the people who want to sit outside and then ensure that they come in and things like that. But in terms of...
Can I have a follow-up then?
Yeah.
So I really appreciate your approach of saying, well, you know, I kind of have to read the class first and see where they're at. Because like learning, I think in a transformative learning is a maturation. Mm-hmm. In a perfect scenario in the springtime, you don't necessarily like, you might have some ideas formulating in your head about maybe this, maybe this, maybe this, but you're not putting anything on paper until you're like, okay, let's read the class, let's get a sense for the class dynamics, and then you're kind of like, okay, I had a few ideas in the air, and then let's kind of,
I leave myself options, and then I'll also work with the elders who come in, and I'll often talk with them about, or they'll often, if I don't bring it up, they'll ask me, where's the class at, what kind of class is it, and they will also tailor the work that they do
right
to the class based on what I'm able to share with them about it. So the sort of they will direct the way that they do the workshop. They will share different things based on the class as a whole. So if the class is a whole, I've had classes where it's really full of the Indigenous Studies program students.
Right.
And so I'm sort of focusing on my Indigenous Ways of Knowing course because it's the most explicitly applied that. I've had that course where it's mostly program students who are mostly very connected.
Right.
And so the depth in which I and the elders share knowledge is much deeper, much quicker.
Right.
Whereas I have classes where half the class may be in international students.
Right.
And so there's a lot more foundational work that needs to go in before we can get to something like that. But what I've found interesting about the international students is they often are able to really connect with the applied pieces.
Right.
Because we're doing something, and so they can watch, they can observe, they can participate more fully than if we're having a discussion in a language that's maybe their second language.
Right.
And they're often able to apply parts of their own college or where they come from to the work that we're doing. And so most recently some students were talking about how they actually have been weavers most of their lives. They use different materials though.
Right.
But they're able to transfer those concepts that they've learned,
right,
which really helps them in the class because they're making connections with how their own culture and it can influence the work and learning that they're doing.
Well, they're literally weaving those two different cultures together
in a
way that's not just literal, but it's sort of deeply, and that's a beautiful. I mean, that must have been amazing. That's,
yeah, it is, and it brings the class together in a much more much different way than, you know, they sit here, they sit there. You know, everyone sits in their little pods, but yeah, the class always changes after the workshop. The relationship with the students have with each other.
Okay.
And I think the comfort they have to share as well.
So you've already hit on this, but it's such a crucial point of what we, I think, almost everyone I've ever talked to here at Kamosun talks about the authenticity, the sense that what we're doing here, that the learning that hopefully the students are getting is authentic. It's real. It connects to the real world, whatever that is. You've kind of talked about where you situate yourself, and that's the foundation. Like you use weaving because it's authentic to your experience, to your grandmother. Like this is authentic knowledge. Like when you think about that, about what you want to do in the class. How do you make sure that it starts someplace in authenticity?
Really explicitly, actually. I'm very clear about what I share comes from and where it comes from. And so I'm really clear that the things that I'm talking about, unless I'm specifically say this is sort of a general idea, I'm talking about knowledge that comes from Chichasias, which is where my family comes from.
Right.
And so it's a very specific, small little area, watershed, that the knowledge that I carry comes from and the knowledge that I share comes from. And so I'm explicit in that way. Can you tell me the question again?
So the authenticity piece.
Right, yes.
So how does, like, when you're thinking, you're formulating these ideas, and you're saying, I want this to ring true, I think in one way, as you've already said, you're demonstrating your knowledge, you're situating your knowledge. This is in some ways like a very graduate school kind of idea of situate your knowledge. You start from a position of situating your knowledge. Maybe that's as the example, like, okay, you have students who are not obviously from, like, who aren't Nunchanov. So they are seeing someone situate their knowledge. And then you're giving them perhaps an example of, like, if you're Cree, situate your knowledge. Where does your knowledge come from?
And as well, too, if you're non-Indigenous. You know, I encourage those students to look into their own backgrounds and ancestry as a way of connecting to the concepts that we're talking about. So the concepts we talk about, you know, if we're talking about identity, for example. How does a non-Indigenous student, how do they connect to what we're talking about, but situating within themselves? Or if we're talking about colonization, how does, you know, I often ask, and then most of the Indigenous students can really, this is how colonization has impacted me. And then I turn to the rest of the class and I ask, how has colonization impacted you? And it's often the first time they've even been asked that question. And then, you know, we talk about that. But in terms of authenticity, I think I try to lead by example, I guess. Don't, I'm always careful to situate what I'm saying. I acknowledge and sort of cite where my knowledge is coming from. And then, you know, I would never, you know, there's courses where they'd like you to talk about the medicine wheel. I won't. I don't come from that. You know, there are a number of courses in our programs that participate in sweats. I don't do that in my class because it's not from, I don't carry that knowledge. And so, I think what it comes down to is understanding my knowledge, but I also know what I'm allowed to share and what I'm not allowed to share. And I understand that, you know, a sweat may be really cool. But I carry no knowledge of that, and so I'm not going to ask students to do something that I'm not going to participate in myself.
But if you had someone come in who was willing, who was from people where this was part of the knowledge.
And we have those, and we have people in our department who do that. And so, you know, that happens for them in other ways. But I guess for me, in the sense of answering the question of authenticity, I'm always careful to be true to myself. And I know if I'm being true to myself, then what I'm sharing is has that authenticity with it. And so part of the cultural education that I have is understanding what I can share and what I can't. And also reading the students as to how much to share and then when to hold stuff back as well. And engaging with them in a way that allows students to show me that they understand what we're talking about, and so that and then showing that they're ready for more.
So it right from the get-go, it seems like your focus is really so... And I want to use this word in the best possible, like an intimate relationship with your students in terms of them as full human beings in relationship with you. And I feel like the authentic, at least what I'm seeing here, the authenticity is starts with that very real and genuine, you know, knowing yourself and then sharing yourself with others in a way that's going to best able those students to grow. Is that?
Yeah, I share my experience. I share my stories as examples of, you know, I use my family or work or research that I'm doing to highlight as a case study for concepts that we're talking about. And I think what it does is when students see me sharing as much as I do about myself, it encourages them to share their stories as well, which then, and that's where we get a fuller picture of the concepts that we're talking about when other students are saying, you know, okay, well, your experience was that, Tommy, and we've just heard it. you know, my experience as a Cree person or a Heltzuk person is this. And then that's where we can really start to get a, gain a fuller picture of, and maybe a slightly more authentic picture of certainly the diversity of Indigenous peoples.
Right.
Rather than this idea of like the pan-Indian.
Yeah, they don't say that about white people.
No.
Funny enough. Yeah. Okay, we'll move into the fourth piece here. And again, you can see how closely these are all related, the idea of reflection. Mm-hmm. Obviously, and there's a place where, and we'll get to a little later, about the idea of place for student reflection. Can you talk about when you have reflective... when you reflect on your practices as an educator, as a person in relationship with these other students, what is your like reflective practice? If you wanted to walk through like the whole cycle from it's springtime in a mythical place and you have time to think about the next semester to the whole way through that semester, like, can you talk a little bit about your process of reflection on everything that's happening in the class?
It's constant.
Yeah.
I do. I think I'm, you know, I'm thinking about, I'm teaching the course I'm teaching right now. I've started thinking about next year already,
right,
based on the group that I've got. And so my courses are, I think, are always being redeveloped, based on new experiences and new questions and things. But so, yeah, I do over the spring, summer tend to do, that's when I tend to do a lot of the work and thinking about and setting up of things for the, you know, fall and winter terms. But I mean, I'm constantly reflecting on what's going on. And I think it's a necessary piece of how I do or how I teach.
Okay.
And that constant reflection is necessary because, you know, something may come up and then I'll reflect on, you know, that question and whether or not it needs to be built in. Right. Can I tie in the next week's to better answer that?
Right.
What's, you know, the questions that came up.
So, and that, I think that answer is very common almost about everyone I've talked to, is that constant state of assessing and reassessing. Do you have like a practice? Like, if you notice things, oh, that went great, oh, that was really, do you write it down in a journal? Or are you like, hey, I think I would like, I would tweak this, the bringing in the elders seemed a little premature, you know, be careful for next time. Is there a practice you have just like, just sort of pragmatically, is it just you just try to?
I try to keep, mostly it's in my head. And then, you know, there'll be a pocket in my bag that's littered with scrap notes.
Or
I'll tend to write things down on the current course outline.
Right.
And then file that away somewhere. So little things like that, but, typically it's just in my head and as I experience things with different classes and different students, then I make slight adjustments. But, you know, one of the big things I can remember is trying to figure out where the Cedar Workshop needs to fit into the course. And so, I've tried different things and it sort of sits in around the beginning after the first month now,
because it
gives me enough time to, you know, interact with the students, figure out where they are. But it also allows me to make sure that they've got a couple of really key pieces of the course content prior to going into that.
Right.
And it's also, you know, the first month can tend to be heavy because that's when a lot of the colonization pieces come up.
Right.
And so the workshop tends to be that break from... you know, harder, more emotional discussions that can tend to be more negative.
Right.
And then looking, you do the workshop, you know, the students, the elders will talk about how the cedar is healing and cleansing. And so the students, you know, go through that process over a couple of weeks and then they move into the more positive aspects of Indigenous ways of knowing.
Right.
One thing I'll mention too is that with the cedar workshops, we initially, we're just going to do one class where the elders will come in and they get to weave something. But But after some discussion, we decided that's not as effective as a learning tool. And so we actually spend 2 weeks doing a workshop. The first week is we come in with extremely pro-set, like right. The elders, we've gone through a year of work to get it to this place, but then the students have to process it to the cedar, to the place where they can actually weave with it. Right. So we spend three hours, one class, doing that. And what we realized early on was that going through this process is very similar to the learning process that they're going through, right?
Right.
They have to put in the time and the effort to get to the place where they can really start to learn what it is that they wanted to learn, right, or were maybe coming to learn, and then they get to see what they've created out of that learning process.
Right.
So, well, oddly enough, we don't necessarily talk about that other than very subtly.
Right.
And it sort of just kind of hit me that maybe I need to actually be explicitly saying,
right,
this is why and this is a piece of it. But
yeah,
so that it's that applied learning piece that, you know, those 2 weeks really stand for the entirety of the course and
right,
can stand for the entirety of this type of education.
Yeah, and I know that I've talked with other instructors, we talked about meta pedagogy, mm-hmm, laying out our pedagogy for students. And again, in a way that they can, you're not trying to overwhelm a first year student here that, mm-hmm, you know, they got a lot of other things and you don't have to overwhelm them with pedagogy, but just kind of say, hey, this see what we're doing here. Mm-hmm. This kind of is symbolic or metaphoric or practical or parallels, mm-hmm, the kind of transition we're going through this whole class.
Mm-hmm.
I think that can be very useful to yeah, putting students, again, as the instructor, you don't own in its entirety the pedagogy. You mm-hmm share the pedagogy.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on now. We're going to talk a little bit, and again, you can see how these ideas, there's no clear line between instructor and student, that they definitely blend together. I want to talk a little bit about, and you have preparing, training, orientation for your students.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about putting off trying to find the right part to get the students ready for this practice.
Mm-hmm.
How do you prepare yourself to guide an activity, experiential learning activity, mm-hmm, like you described? Like, how do you ready yourself for it?
A lot of that comes from my culture,
right?
And so the there's a lot of cultural pieces that I will rely on, but won't necessarily share, but
right.
Yeah, so those pieces that I have from my cultural education are really important to this particular, the Cedar Workshop, which tends
right
to be really more of an indigenous kind of applied learning. But I try to prepare myself by, that's a really good question, because with the cedar, which is often the piece that I use, I've grown up with it my entire life, so it's almost become that,
right,
it's just that thing, oh yeah, I just do that. So I don't, I haven't had to, I've been asked to think about this before.
It's the ball glove you've had your whole life.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's the, I have that privilege and I sit in there, so I don't necessarily see it very well.
Okay, well, while you're thinking, pondering that one, you work with community partners.
Mm-hmm.
This is, like you've already described, and what you've done before you formally came to teaching here. What's your preparation like in terms of orienting the students and the elders, for example?
Mm-hmm.
What's your process there? Like, is it any different than your own preparation, or how do you work with community to get to that right learning?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say it's different. I would say that so the way that I was raised and the cultural education that I have, the teachings that we are that are shared with, well, the teachings that have been shared with me are a part of who I am. They're a part of how I go about my life, right? They guide how I do things every day. So right. I think that might be the difficulty in trying to explain my practice right. from the earlier question, is that it's practice that is daily. It's a constant thing in my life. Right. And so the teachings are what guide the way that I try to behave. They guide me in the choices that I make on a daily basis. Right. So we try to embody the teachings as much as we can. When I'm engaging with community or with students, you know, my wife doesn't say this to me so much. It was early on when I just began teaching. And whenever I go to do some speaking that's not necessarily a normal part of my
right.
life or week, she reminds me, don't shame the family.
Right.
And so we laugh about that. And because it is funny, right? Don't shame the family. But that's her humorous and not so subtle reminder to me that I'm a representation of my family
right.
and my community and my nation. And so when I engage with students, I keep that in mind. One of those students may one day end up in my community. And if,
right.
if our interaction and our learning together as teacher and student, is positive, you know, right. that's going to be good. If it's negative, it has consequences. And so I try to keep that in mind all the time, this idea that, it's not even an idea. After how old am I? 38 now, right? It's 38 years of learning to embody the teachings and live the teachings that have been shared with me. And so those are expressed every day in how I interact with and build relationship with people.
Okay.
And so in community, it's particularly important because community members know who I am. They know who my family is.
Right.
And so within the community setting, that's where sort of cultural teachings and protocols can take place as well. And we have cultural ways of dealing with bad, poor behavior.
Right.
And I would certainly not want to,
shame your family.
Shame my family in that way because I was disrespectful or something. And so it's about learning to walk in a good way, in a careful way, in a respectful way, and it's okay not to know what to do necessarily, but part of the relationship building process is learning who to ask.
Right.
And so there are now people in community I can go to and I can ask questions that I may be like completely obvious or I can stumble through because I don't know how to ask. But that comes with, spending time and building relationships. And so I think that's an important piece of the implied learning that I do, is ensuring that my relationships are strong enough with community members, with elders, so that they have faith that in me that, if something does come up, it's not a reflection of them, but it's, and so I can act as that sort of middle piece that between, I can address things that an elder may not, for a various number of reasons want to or be able to.
Right. Okay. So we're going to turn now. Thank you. That was an amazing answer. So when you're, the language here is monitoring, reflection, and continuous improvement. And again, it's so built into everything you've already talked about. But recognizing that sometimes activities don't always go as planned, sometimes for better and sometimes for worse, and that's what goes. How do you assess the student's experience in light of your goals? What were you hoping for?
I had one of those. I had a real bomber of a class. A number of things, but I'm honest about those things, If I can see that students aren't getting it or I'm not you know, I'm clearly not explaining the concept in a way that people are understanding it.
Right.
I'm honest about it, you know, and we'll have a discussion or maybe around. So I'll turn a bomber into a, right. into a learning opportunity where we can discuss, you know, what might be a better way to approach this? How can I adjust the way that I teach to better better present this information to people who maybe aren't in line with what I'm thinking or doing?
Right.
And so I try and take those opportunities and shift them into a place where we can have a discussion or we can create some kind of dialogue on things. And partly what it does, I think, is it shows students that, you know, I think a lot of times there's this idea, this power dynamic that mm-hmm. people think exists, or that probably does exist.
Right.
And so, you know, it shows students that, you know, I screw up. I can acknowledge it. I can be humble,
right.
You know, about that. And I'm willing to work on with, you know, as a group, we can work through a concept, even if I'm having difficulty trying to explain it, or, you know, people aren't understanding the way that I'm trying to teach it. And I think that comes from this idea that, you know, I don't see myself as an instructor, but as a teacher, right? And so this idea, too, that the students are there. We're all engaging ourselves as learners and teachers at all times.
Right.
And so, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's an echo. That answer is echoed many different times. Mm-hmm. The simple idea of humility, you're modeling good, I mean, this is, I would say, personal behavior, but also mm-hmm. academic behavior. Mm-hmm. When you screw up, say, yeah, it didn't go the way I hoped it would go here.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah.
Let's figure it out. To me, that feels like that's good practice
mm-hmm.
as a human being, as an academic. Like, I thought this was it, and it isn't.
And I think it's good for students who go on to be leaders to see someone who sits maybe in a place of power
right.
within this institution be able to say, you know, that was a mess, sorry,
right, yeah,
let's try and back it up and we'll see if we can work, you know,
yeah.
pick out the pieces that are still useful from this.
I think that in the experience I've heard from other instructors, certainly my own experience, when you have that rapport with the students that you built some trust with them,
mm-hmm.
when you do screw up and say, this isn't working, folks. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, I don't see it here. I don't think you're feeling it. Am I right about mm-hmm. that? I think that there's like a sense of relief.
Mm-hmm.
And then students are like, oh, good. This, you know, Tommy sees this. It wasn't just me seeing this.
Yeah.
And then you're like, well, let's reset. And how do we take this on? I always feel like, you know, you can turn what was not going well and you can turn around and all of a sudden people come out at the end of the class and like, oh,
yeah,
hey, that was fabulous.
Yeah.
And completely, like, going back to our original conversation about un-high-schooling this,
mm-hmm.
not a, you know,
mm-hmm.
not a position you'd often hear
mm-hmm.
in that context. But here you can be, you know, you can show that full sight.
Yeah, and I think, too, part of it is it's about... part of our philosophy from my cultural education is this idea that we're always striving to be human beings, and so right. human being is something that we're always working to do, and part of that is understanding your place, understanding your being humble or having humility and things like
right.
that, right? And so sometimes, as you pointed out, right, the class that is not going well, when you back it up, you acknowledge it's not going well, and then you ask students for their input into
right.
things, right, and involve them in making the experience a better one.
Right.
I think it's almost as valuable,
right.
if not more valuable than you know, running a good class.
Right? Right.
Because it engages students in the learning again, and then they're actively involved in the creation of something good from something that
right.
was maybe a mess.
Yeah, and there's a sense of ownership that it's not just, hey, Tommy screwed up or Dan screwed mm-hmm. up. It's like, this isn't working for us.
Yeah.
And when other, when we collectively say, yeah, yeah, it's not working. Okay, well, we can laugh about it because yeah. that's a good way to approach it sometimes. And then, okay, how do we address it? And it's that we, that sense yeah. of community. Well, yeah, there's always instructor and, the, and teacher and student. You can show that humility.
Yeah, it can. We can all have our roles, but it can be our classroom. It can be our, yeah. our course. Yeah. yeah.
Okay, let's move on. We're going to talk a little bit about assessment and evaluation. I'm interested to have your thoughts on how do you, given your emphasis, how do you assess? Like, what is your process for assessment when you're looking at applied learning, mm-hmm. experiential learning?
I often ask for a critical reflection on the applied learning pieces because I don't want to, you know, have an applied learning and then have a test because I feel that the test takes right. away or causes anxiety, right?
Right.
And so I often ask for students to write a critical reflection. And over the years, my, you know, a couple sentences has grown into several paragraphs on right. what I actually mean.
Right.
But I want, I find critical reflections to be really useful because it allows the students to have a really wide field of what they can talk about. And so when we're in the beauty of an applied learning piece is that every student is going to take something different away from that learning.
Right.
And so with through a critical reflection, and you know, I'm really explicit that it's not a summary.
Right, right, right.
I was there. I've yeah. done this a bunch of times. Yeah. Right. I don't need you to remind me what it is that we did. But and so the strongest ones are always the ones who are taking the applied learning as a point of departure for how they experience their life, how they've experienced, how they're understanding education now,
right.
How they're understanding the knowledge that they carry.
Right.
And so that's what I ask of them is mostly in terms of evaluation or assessment after an applied learning piece right. is to talk about how they relate to what it is. And they're often, it'll be very, very, very different because of everyone's
experience. So how do you assess them that a critical review?
I look for, so I'm really, really explicit in
right.
what students should be looking for or writing about.
Right.
So if you've summarized, it's not going right. to go well.
Right.
But if you are able to, so people who will get top marks for a mm-hmm. critical reflection will be the ones who can connect the applied learning to the content that we've discussed in class. Any of the materials that I've had them read, any of the films or guests who maybe have come
right.
in, as well as connect it to their own cultural experience or
right.
educational experience or experience more generally.
Right.
And so how I'll see that happening is the student will make connections to, you know, when we were weaving, it reminded me of a time when I was learning that from right. my grandparents. Or,
and that applies to the, and that reminded me of the reading we did in the third week that,
yeah.
that reminded me of the elder who talked about this.
Yeah.
Just drawing that web.
Yeah. Or you know, and when we talked about worldview, we maybe watched this film and you know, there was a piece of that film that really I connect with now. And so
right.
if they're able to pull all of the pieces that we're learning and using
right.
Into their reflection in a very explicit way
right.
As well, because sometimes they're doing it in a really inexplicit way and I can see it
right, right.
because I've spent the time to
right, right, right.
understand who they are. But yeah, so the ones who
but
are...
But is that meta, it again, that yes. like self-awareness.
Yes.
Yeah.
And being able to, yeah, draw those pieces together and do it well and concisely right. and in 3 pages.
No problem.
Yeah, right, so.
Okay, well, that sounds very interesting. I know that for a lot of instructors, we're more and more focusing on seeing the courses as like holistic pieces, mm-hmm. not merely little tiny fragments of yeah. knowledge like that somehow get poured into your head and you spit out at the end of the semester.
Yeah, not little units.
Yeah, but actually connecting webs of understanding
mm-hmm.
that hopefully help you grow a sense of a critical view or a paradigm or whatever the language is you want to use. Okay, let's go on to the last piece. Acknowledgement. So if learning is transformative, and I think most people who teach here would say it is, how do you celebrate student transformation?
I am a firm believer in constant acknowledgement and validation of learning. And so I ask for several critical reflections in most of my classes throughout the year. And then I also, for most of my classes, I don't do like a final paper anymore. I do a presentation.
Okay.
I've found that the presentation, it's much harder to hide.
Right.
You can hide in a paper if you don't, you know, right, understanding things because writing and that, right? But I find that I can see what students have learned much more clearly in a presentation. And so in some ways, the presentation, as scary as they are an acknowledgement of the student's learning, because right, that's when they're sharing, and they're often sharing something more personal, their own story or their own understanding. And so the class, you see the class engage.
Right.
I'm always really careful to ask questions that will lead to more of a positive experience.
Right.
In reflections, I tend to write just all over.
Right.
And so I'm always careful to remind students too that just because I'm writing a lot doesn't mean that it's bad.
Right.
But in there, I encourage students, you know, most of my comments, you know, a lot of the time it'll be work on editing.
Right.
You know, I think that's the sort of the standard thing we all have to write. Please work on your editing and things like that. But I always try to comment in a way that builds students up. So, right, you know, I'll say, you know, something like, okay, you need to work here, right, but you did a really good job here, or, you know, this paragraph was really excellent, or things right, like that. In the classroom itself, I try to validate the questions, even if I'm like, well, where did that question come from? Right. Because I want to encourage students to be comfortable to ask questions in whatever way they have to ask them. And if we need to work on a better way to ask that question,
right,
we talk about that. Within the programs that I teach, most of the Indigenous students who are program students,
right,
they have a lot of support,
right,
throughout the program. You know, and so like for IFS, I think there's three of us that teach in that program now, and
right,
or with that are within our Indigenous right, department. So we meet and we make sure that you know, the students have the support they need. Again, I think this comes down to embodying the teachings that I have and right, wanting to show support and encouragement for students at all times.
Right.
And so, you know, even if it's recognizing that, you know, a student who's very quiet asks a question,
right?
I maybe won't call, you know, I won't draw attention to the fact, but I'll send them an email later saying, you know, that was a really great question. I'm really happy that you shared it and things like that. So it kind of depends on the student too,
because...
You know, or sometimes, you know, we've had questions that cause a lot of like, what did you just say? Right. And so trying to not necessarily encourage that question again,
right.
You know, if it's really a misguided sort of understanding,
right,
but to address it in a way that the student asking doesn't feel like, oh my God, I can never ask a question again. That was
right,
so awful.
Right.
Right.
Maybe get to the intention of the question,
yeah,
as opposed to like, okay, maybe this question, the assumptions under this question might not be really great.
Yeah,
but your intention might have been like, you were earnest in this question.
Yeah, you know, or I'll comment that, oh yeah, okay, this is a question that comes up a lot, but we don't often understand that asking it in this way is,
right,
there's better ways to ask it. Right. So, you know, I also try to ensure that all of the students, and it takes probably way more work, but I try to ensure that I'm meeting every single student where they're at. And so, right. You know, sometimes you'll get students who come in with very little knowledge. And so, you know, in terms of like a chart, they're like
right.
off the chart with what right. they've learned. And then you have students who come in who are deeply cultural and connected. And so, you know, their learning, if it was charted, it would right. look minimal. And so I try to meet students where they're at.
Right.
And so, you know, a student who does this,
right.
you know, in terms, yes, they've done a ton of learning, but the student who went this far,
right.
based on what all they already know,
right.
maybe he did a huge amount of learning too. And so
right.
trying, working really hard not to, you know, okay, here's the top student,
yeah.
right? But
yeah,
going, yeah. okay, and part of that is through the assessments and the assignments that I use.
Yeah, I think that's one of the challenges that, you know, we do want to celebrate excellence when we see mm-hmm. it because of that hard work and that devotion and everything. But I think there's also just the human element of, I teach in UT, University Transfer, and I always say this is the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about trajectory, whether you're starting, the same metaphor basically, if you're starting at zero or you're starting at a 50 meter line for 100 meter race, which the class inevitably will,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't matter, it's just first year.
Yeah.
It's your trajectory. What's your direction? Mm-hmm. Celebrate your direction. If your direction's yeah. heading the right way, we have a long way to get there.
Yeah. And I feel because I'm teaching in college prep, and then I teach a certificate program, and then I'm teaching the Indigenous Studies program, right?
Right.
With the expectations that they have
yeah.
up to well, university.
Right.
I feel that I have a more of a responsibility to support and encourage students to continue going than I do to, you know, occasionally you get the one where it's like, why are you here?
Right.
Right?
You need to think more seriously about
yes.
why you're here. Yeah.
But I tend not to focus on, I focus on the people who show up and the people who are in the room with me want, you know, I feel like because they've showed up, they want to be there.
Right.
And so, you know,
okay.
It's a good question. How do you acknowledge? I want students to leave this class feeling like education is something that they can, or my class is feeling like education is something that's good,
yeah.
and not scary, and something that, you know, if they wanted to pursue, they can.
Right.
And so in some ways that's the acknowledgement piece.
Right.
Is you know, letting them know that. You know, for the Indigenous family support, the last thing I always talk to the students about
right.
as they, you know, head on to the next thing is a reminder that despite all of the impacts that our people have had,
right.
we are the strongest people because we're the descendants of the people who survived.
Right.
You know, the disease, the genocides, the residential schools, the six, right? We're right. descendants of the strongest of our people, and so that's what I want them to remember as they go off into
right.
you know other things, or where they venture out into things that are not within right. our program, and so, you know, I try to leave students with that kind of encouragement,
a sense of confidence,
yeah, a sense of confidence that yeah. what they know and who they are is a key piece of the education that they can
yeah.
have.
I think that's amazing. Any final thoughts that have percolated through the interview? Any final ideas? Or
no, applied learning, yay. I love the idea of experiential or applied learning. And so, you know, the more that we can, that the college sort of gets behind and supports that
right.
those things, I think the stronger student base will be sending out into the working world or onto universities.
Okay. Well, with that, thanks very much, Tommy. I really appreciate your time and your amazing insights.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.